Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This episode of Happy Hour is sponsored by Gold Star. Gold Star has a great selection of affordable tickets to all sorts of live events, including theater, with Broadway and Broadway national tours, concerts, comedy, dance, and more.
The first 200 listeners who use the promo code HAPPYHOUR, one word, all caps, will get $10 off their purchase at goldstar.com/happyhour or using the Gold Star app. Welcome to Jim and Tomic's Musical Theatre. Oh, we haven't done any sort of preamble.
Faux.
Faux. Speaking of faux.
Yes.
Have you ever tried pho?
Yes, I've tried pho. Do they have pho in Scotland?
I have had pho.
In Scotland?
In Scotland, yeah. There's actually a really nice Vietnamese restaurant called the Hanoi Bake Club that if you ever come visit, I will take you to.
That sounds fantastic. Pho is like wonderful, I feel sick food.
Yes.
It is so good if you've got like a cold or it's winter.
I've made pho.
Well, good. Look at... And he's single, gentlemen.
Right? I've made like a collection of warming soups.
We just got back from camping in Yellowstone and like had to pack in all our meals and stuff. And, you know, we're not great campfire cooks. We're not great cooks to begin with. So it was like hot dogs and cereal and oatmeal and eggs.
Yep.
And we met another fun couple there who invited us to their campsite for dinner. And really the discussion was like, well, should we go back to your campsite or our campsite? And they were like, well, what do you have for dinner? And I was like, well, we've got hot dogs on long tongs that we're going to roast over the campfire. And they were like, oh, we're making gnocchi with a mushroom cream sauce and roasted zucchini sided with some bread with Gouda cheese melted on it. And we're like, oh, so your place it is.
Yes.
It was delicious and put our cooking skills to shame.
I wouldn't say no to just like a wiener on a fire.
He's single, gentlemen.
Will somebody get us another drink?
Welcome to Jim and Tomic's Musical Theatre Happy Hour, your weekly podcast with wine and wiggles.
Do you mean
wiggles? Look at all those wiggles.
Wiggles is in the dance move or Wiggles is in the Australian children's singing group?
All Wiggles.
All Wiggles.
You must have seen. You must have seen that though.
The Wiggles.
The Army, the Arts and Crafts Department.
Uh huh.
You must have seen her.
No.
Oh my God! The Magic Sponge Lady.
You're saying words as if I understand them.
Okay. First show note of the day.
Magic Sponge Lady. I'm going to spend the rest of the podcast imagining what the Magic Sponge Lady is.
Oh, you haven't lived until. No flab on this arm. Flab on this arm. Endless quotes.
I'm so excited.
She's the best.
I've never been so excited for an internet thing.
What you drinking, sir?
I can tell you what I'm not drinking.
What?
A drop of red wine.
Excellent.
Don't want to ruin the Calvin Klein. Which is
Chanel Gaultier.
Which is bizarre, because like, I mean, maybe I just live in a schlubby Target world, but like when a girl says she's wearing Calvin Klein, you assume it's like an outfit. And when a guy says he's wearing Calvin Klein, you assume it's underwear. Maybe that's true. Just me. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
No, I think that's true. And yeah, Calvin, maybe just in our little Midwestern world.
Our Midwestern world, your Midwestern Scottish world.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you?
Because I guess there's like Calvin Klein suits.
There are Calvin Klein suits. I don't podcast in a Calvin Klein suit, Jimmy. I know this disappoints all our listeners.
I know. I podcast in a ball gown.
What are you drinking today?
I am not enjoying a fine Chardonnay.
Ah, good. Clever, because it's in all of them. Yeah.
Yes. So that's funny, though, because we said podcast with wine, and they were both drinking wine.
Oh, look at that.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers to... It seems appropriate for this show.
Sure. Absolutely. So Tommy is with Aquaman.
To our knowledge, this show is one of the only Broadway musicals to include a full stage splash guard for audience protection.
Now, read the question. That's what I'm going to say. Splash guard. Splash guard. Not splash zone. We have a lot of Evil Dead people.
Which does have a splash zone. This one has a splash guard. And there guard. Is... I tracked down the story. Duncan Sheik confirms it. They did splatter some poor lady's very expensive purse in the front row, despite the splash guard.
Well, what I loved is that in a weird, like, metaphysical way, article that was describing this like went right in on like the labels, like it was a Burberry handbag and a Valentino scarf, and I was like, you understand.
But Jimmy, the people are confused because they don't know what show we're talking about yet.
Oh yeah, we haven't said that yet. We're talking about American Psycho the musical.
It took me 19 years, but I finally developed a good relationship with my body.
Today, computers are management tools, giving you a competitive edge.
24-hour, person-to-person service with every checking account. Where's the nearest ATM?
I don't clean anymore. Because none of these ordinary cleaners give me what I want.
Whenever I shower, sometimes twice, sometimes three times a day, I use a honey almond wash on my ripped body and an exfoliating spearmint gel on my face. I apply Clinique Moisturizer and an anti-aging eye balm before I shave with a razor and cream by Pour Homme. No cologne on the face ever, as the high alcohol content dries out your skin and makes you look older.
Milk's about the best thing I can drink right now to help me build strong arms,
powerful legs, and a broad chest. And when all my work is done, will you love me just for my body?
I can live with that.
Milk. It does a body good.
My suit that was such today a tiny is reveal.
I know. Flusser. But that's good. It's very on brand.
It is very on brand.
Right? We don't care about anything.
No.
It's the 80s.
Yes. It's the 80s.
Welcome.
American Psycho the Musical. Music and lyrics by Duncan Sheik of...
Spring Awakening.
Spring Awakening fame. Sorry.
Yep.
The big block fell down in my mental brain.
That's all right. It happens. yes, indeed. We have the book by Roberto Aguirre Sacasa, who has done quite a lot of TV. He's done some stuff for Archie Comics. But, of course, we are so grateful for him helping out with the book of Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark.
He is the book doctor.
Yes.
That fixed the show after Julie Taymor got the boot.
Yes. He swept in on his web and made it a tiny bit better.
Yes. only a little bit. He's also a huge comic books writer. He is like in charge of Archie Comics, basically.
Yes. And has been kind of pinpointed and grabbed. Like, he was in talks to do the Little Shop film remake.
Yeah.
So seems to go in for this like kind of culty horror.
Yeah, definitely. Like these campy big horror sort of things. I think he's a drama school grad from Yale, I want to say. Sure. Might have made that up. Who knows? Yeah. We'll Yale School of Drama. Ha!
Well done.
Boom. Take that.
And the Glee episodes he wrote were all right.
High praise coming from Jimmy. American Psycho is also based on the novel of the same name by Bret Easton Ellis, and also the very popular cult classic 2000 movie.
Yes, indeed. So the musical itself premiered in my neck of the woods on the West End in 2013, starring Doctor Who.
Oh, it's ridiculous. It's so silly. It's so silly. It's like it's the Steve from Blue's Clues problem. Have you heard this thing where the actor who played, do you know Blue's Clues, the Nick Jr. television
show? We're all
looking
for Blue's
Clues. Yeah, there you go. Right. Yep. And the guy, Steve, was like, while he was on Blue's Clues, also had like a role as a murderer on Law and Order.
Oh, great.
And there was huge outcry because, like, my toddler saw Steve murder someone on Law and Order. Oh, this is the worst. He quit Blue's Clues because he was like, I don't want to be Steve the rest of my life. I would like to have a career as an actor. He's an interesting character. But Matt Smith will always be Doctor Who, even when he's not. I think it's the Doctor Who problem. And so to have him play Patrick Bateman, interesting choice.
Exactly. But in many ways, Doctor Who is also a psychopath. So
True. It's
all good. So it hot-footed over to Broadway in 2015.
Where it tumbled and flopped spectacularly.
Poof, poof.
Yeah.
Yes. And we'll chat all about why that may have happened. I was going to say may or may not have happened.
No, why it absolutely happened. It played 80 performances and closed before the Tony Awards that year, which is always a bad sign.
Very, very bad. Where do you begin?
Oh,
American
man.
Psycho.
American Psycho.
I'm going to preface. it's probably one of my all-time favorite movies. And I absolutely adore the book, too.
Jimmy's been waiting a long time for us to do this episode.
I have. Yeah, and we'll talk about... I told you my journey of me and this musical.
Your hate-love relationship with this show.
Exactly. So we'll get into that.
American Psycho tells the story of Patrick Bateman, a Wall Street businessman in the 80s, late 80s, experiencing the huge Wall Street boom of that time. He is an asshole, he's a womanizer, and is also deemed decidedly boring by his friends, but also has a secret nightlife as a serial murderer and rapist. Yeah.
Yes, he is. That's him.
It chronicles his descent into his own psychosis and bloodlust and how, you know... It really doesn't even make him unique, despite his best efforts.
Exactly. And the whole thing is kind of tossed up in a salad of, is this real?
Yeah.
Is it not? Because he is the unreliable narrator.
Mm-hmm.
But is he even that? There's lots of questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
All tossed up into the salad.
With a hefty side of, late stage capitalism, consumerist ideology and critique,
exactly,
along with a really hefty critique of yuppie culture.
Yeah, because this is really kind of the birth of yuppie culture.
Yeah,
a lot of people describe the 80s as the beginning of the end.
Yeah,
and this kind of goes right in on that because it's it takes place in New York, which is the kind of center of the 80s.
Yeah,
in so many ways. So yeah, it's a proper look.
It really is.
World.
And if you have seen the movie, which I imagine is most people's entry into this media, the musical is the same story, but there's a really interesting spin on it having the kind of music that's attached to it. It certainly has bits and pieces of the actual period music that is so prevalent in the film and the book. But then Duncan Sheik's additional songs in his own kind of synth pop way are appropriate for the time ish.
Certainly some of them you could imagine would be, hits by whatever new wave band you're listening to at the time. Like,
exactly. But it does add a really interesting edge to the show.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like unrepresented on Broadway.
Yeah.
In its entirety, maybe?
Yeah. The show's weird. The show's unique. I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk about it. Chanel, Gautier, or Giorgio Armani, Moschino, Alaya, or Norma Kamali. So hello. I think, well, I'll just say my journey now.
Okay.
I'll get it out of the way.
Yeah.
So yeah, I saw the movie years and years and years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Like pre-uni, whenever that was.
Okay.
It was like really into, because it was during my whole like, I love wanky cinema.
Uh-huh.
Type. So I was like, oh, this is cool, it's allegorical, mm-hmm. you know, get into this. And then I read the book, and the book is like a whole different kettle of fish.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And completely different, and completely different from anything I've ever read.
Mm-hmm.
And I just keep, it's one of those ones I do keep going back to,
mm-hmm.
because you can't read it all on the first read.
Yeah, okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really jarring, it's very disconcerting. It's more graphic than any of the other fictional representations, the musical or the movie.
Yeah.
There's so much more there, and mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, because it is the source material, so it's right. gonna
well, and also, I mean, I think Ellis is on record in some discussions, the author of the book, yeah. saying that, like, while he enjoys the movie, that it gives too many answers, and that's one of the mm-hmm. problems with it being a film, is, like, you yeah. can't be as ambiguous as you can be with a book.
Exactly. Yeah, because I think he said, like, the movie genre itself demands answers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's when you go to a movie, you want an ending.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this book doesn't really have that at all.
Uh-huh.
And it's actually quite interesting the way that the musical plays with this. So, yeah, the first time I heard the musical, I had a friend who went to see it in London.
Okay.
And told me about it. And was like, oh my God, you're going to love this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I listened to Cash Garden, and I was like, no, I think this is the worst thing I've probably ever encountered in my life.
Uh-huh.
I just hated it because it was just, it was kind of making a mockery of this piece of fiction that mm-hmm. I really highly regard.
Yeah.
And then I listened again.
Yeah.
And then I listened again. Then I watched some of it and then just slowly but surely became like obsessed with it.
Uh-huh.
And I now, like, it's one of my go-to listens.
Really?
So in 2017, you know, they did that, like, Spotify, what is your most listened to,
uh-huh. you they, know, like, send you the email. Thing. Yeah.
Matt Smith is my most listened to artist of 2017.
Oh, which is, you are probably unique in that way.
I think I probably would be. And I was quite sad about it, but also, you know, secretly yeah. proud. But yeah, so I've really grown to...
Mm-hmm.
to have a place in my heart. It's not perfect, it's actually quite bad in a lot of ways,
uh-huh.
but in many, you know, and I think there are other these like cult musicals
yeah
that aren't good, but some people are just obsessed
really
over
obsessed with them.
I think it kind of falls into one of those categories.
I wrote this much further down, but I see a lot, or not a lot, but I see plenty of parallels between American Psycho the musical and Carrie the musical.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
Not good. Like, objectively not good in a lot yeah. of ways. But people love them so much that they want them to continue to exist.
Totally. Or, yeah, it's in, again, they want it to excel. They want it to
yeah, they exist want, in they a want good more way. People to experience it for whatever it is because of some, you know, some indescribable piece of it that must be shared for some reason.
Yeah.
Which I do, like, I feel that. I don't think I would call myself an American Psycho stan yet.
Uh-huh.
But having gotten into it for, like, in prep for this podcast, you know, I watched the film for the first time yesterday. I see why there's that scuttlebutt around this thing. And it makes me really curious about, like, why it's not still playing on Broadway.
Yeah.
You know?
So, right. So, you're talking about how you watched the film. What did you think about the film?
I thought it was beautiful. Like, it's definitely...
Weird choice of words.
I thought it was very, very cinematically stunning. I see why it is an American cult classic. I think it, you know, is a really solid film. That is an interesting blending of, like, a black comedy and a slasher, which is not, I imagine, in, what, 2000, when the movie came out, was not yeah. a terribly explored genre. Like, it is really well filmed, it is really yeah. well paced, you know, and it is one of those, I feel like there are these kind of cult classic films. Like, I watched the movie for the first time yesterday and saw plenty of scenes that I know I have, like, already experienced.
Yeah.
Like, it is such in, it is so ingrained in pop culture that, like, it's impossible to not have experienced part of this movie already before totally. Sitting down to watch it for the first time. But I thought it was really good. You know, and like an interesting, you don't get a lot of popular movies that are so filled with allegory, that are, you know, so like appropriately deep. I wish I had a better adjective. But yeah. like, and with such an ambiguous ending, and with,
yeah.
you know, so much like combination of absurdity and terror in them.
Totally. Because, yeah, I don't know. I find it, it's strange because one of the things that people do always kind of come away with is that they talk about the comic element.
Yeah.
And when we kind of go into why it might not have worked on Broadway, I think that's something that I definitely want to discuss a bit more, because for me, it's never really been any sort of comedy. Like, even it could be like the blackest of black comedy.
Yeah.
But not in a, I don't know, just more in a, you're looking at the world through a different lens.
But I think, do you know what I mean? There's like, there is something intrinsically funny about an axe wielding murderer doing his business to Huey Lewis in the news. It's funny. That's funny on its own without context. That's funny like a clown walking down the street is funny. Like,
yeah, I guess.
You know, there is comedy in here. And so then you ask, like, that comedy in the spectrum of the broader thing, does it diminish the comedy or broaden the comedy in all these, you know, insert a cat into an ATM. Mm-hmm. That's funny. That's funny on its own. And then,
see, that's, yeah, I guess.
But then you're questioning, like, in the context, it is less funny and more scary and absurd. And, like, that's intentional in the point. You know, like, watching Christian Bale dance around in that raincoat is funny. People make GIFs of it on the internet because it looks funny.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know. I maybe I'm just being too highbrow about it, but I always just, like, I kind of look at it with my face. Do you know? Like,
yeah. Like, I would certainly never pitch to someone like, go see American Psycho, the comedy. Like,
you'll laugh. Right? Yeah.
Certainly not. But I think that adds to it. No, go on.
Because I would say, yeah, like, the comedy that I can see from it comes from the kind of just ridiculousness of all of the characters.
Yeah.
And their priorities and this weird hedonistic world that they live in,
right?
It, like, it's ridiculous, yeah. But it's, to me, it's just, I don't know, it's just not necessarily funny.
Yeah,
like, I'm not laughing at it, I'm just going, like, this is ridiculous. Like, it's almost like it's this weird alternate universe,
yes,
that they live in,
right? But then that's the scary joke. This is not an exit, this is not a parable, this is not an allegory. This is the 80s. Yeah. This is the world we live in.
So, yeah, that's something I always find quite interesting, is that a lot of people call it a comedy.
Yeah. When I do, I think this is something we'll run into in this podcast and in some of the reviews I was reading, and even some of just, like, the scholarly papers that are written about the movie and the book. Like,
yeah.
This piece squarely lives in its own ambiguity. Like, that is super intentional. And the questioning it makes you do is the point, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, you know, different views of comedy versus not comedy is the point. We're both on either side of that tightrope.
I guess.
That's not really how tightropes work, is it?
Both on either side of it, we would both fall to our death. So that, maybe that is how you wanted to phrase that. I don't know. But yeah, so in terms of how the movie and the book tie up with the musical, because it's kind of picked bits from both, because it is now such a cult classic.
Mm-hmm.
What Duncan and Roberto have both done is that they have had to kind of do a bit of fan service in there for both camps.
Yeah.
Now, I would say it's more like the book than the movie.
Yeah. I could see that.
Just because there's more things that happen in it are directly from the book as opposed to the movie. Like, that's about it.
Yeah. But then there are, like, some of the direct imagery from the movie finds its way exactly into the musical. You know, even just like playing Huey Lewis in the news at the end
of
the
act. That's in
the book. Oh, is that? All right. Well, then never mind.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the book, anything that's in the film,
it's pretty much explicitly. All right.
Yep. So the way Huey Lewis in the news plays into it, you know, you've got the, in the film, there's the chase scene. So he does this quite a lot. So the book's all completely narrated by Patrick. And you have the whole chase scene, then it ends really abruptly, and then it goes into like a 12-page description of Huey Lewis in the news. And that's just that, and you just kind of accept it. And that happens quite a few times. The first kind of big murder he does with, I think it's just a homeless woman. He comes in and starts talking about Genesis. Straight after, you know, and it's very disorientating. That's it's totally the intention. And there's a few chapters in the book that are completely there to
just
make
like throw you
go crazy. Basically. So yeah, it's all there. Everything is there. There are little bits like the Tom Cruise in the lift scene. That's in the book.
Okay.
Tom Cruise lives in his building. And you get to see kind of Patrick being... That's one of the first times you see him being a bit awkward and a bit more human, I guess.
Okay.
In the book, certainly.
Yeah. It is interesting because we talk shit about movies adapted into musicals all the time. And I don't feel that way about this one. And I wonder if some of it has to do with that it is a hybrid of a book and a movie.
Yeah.
That, like, it can do the fan service of the movie and get the pop culture audience in, but also can expand upon it with, you know, quote-unquote, stuff you haven't seen if you've seen the movie.
Yeah, I think where the bits that kind of annoys me is because the fan service are such obvious nods.
Okay.
They're such, like, hey!
Yeah.
That everyone feels it compelled to be like, woo!
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's how Mean Girls feels to me. You know?
It's kind of like bingo.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, you get your American Psycho bingo card at the beginning. And
And that kind of upsets him because it stops it from being its own thing. It stops it from telling its own story.
Right.
But that's just a personal gripe. But yeah, one of the other big differences between film and book / musical are the inclusion of his mother and his brother,
Who are not in the movie.
They're not in the movie. They are in the book, but they're very, very different. And I don't think that was one of the things that I really wasn't happy about the first time.
Interesting.
So his brother's actually reasonably successful. And the only interaction they have in the book. It's kind of like a one-upmanship that they have on each other. And he is very much trying to kind of blindside his brother, but his brother isn't having any of it, and his brother keeps kind of batting it all back. Whereas I think in the musical, he's kind of just played as this like ridiculous stoner. And what's weird, so in the book, in that scene, in the dinner party scene, there are two characters who are effectively his brother in the musical.
Okay.
If that makes sense. So they are like Brooklynite stoners.
Right.
Like artist types.
Yeah, but they kind of merge them.
Yeah, to kind of put this into his brother, who isn't actually his brother in the fiction.
Yeah.
Which is
But they do that
annoying.
They do that with a couple, don't they do that with the police officer and is it a lawyer?
His lawyer.
Who turns into the police officer for the musical.
They get kind of merged.
Yeah.
But I think so with the brother thing, the thing that I find tricky is that's his family.
Okay.
So that's like character clues.
Right. Yeah. That is a part of who he is, whereas an exterior character is less important somehow.
Yeah. And so, particularly with when it comes to the mother, like,
her
song is purely talking about Patrick when he was a young boy. is a way for Gene to kind of feel sympathetic towards him.
Yeah.
And like, I'm like, because what you're doing there is you're psychoanalyzing him.
Right.
And you're kind of excusing.
Yeah. Well,
what he's, I mean, you're like paving that way. And I'm like, you can't do that because that isn't, that's not the story.
Right.
Yeah. So that annoyed me. And for me, like, I can see why they've put it in, because it's like, characters need backstory.
Right.
We need more female characters that aren't going to be slaughtered.
Right.
You know, or we, I don't know, it's like, we need a moment for Alice Ripley.
Yeah. Like, which part of it seems like, hey, oh, we accidentally cast Alice Ripley in this. Can we give her some things to do?
Yeah. So that, yeah, I don't like, and I think can just be sliced right out. And do you know what? It can be sliced right out.
Yeah.
There's no reason she's
and no
there.
One will know. I do think, like, on the whole, it is interesting, having watched the movie after knowing the musical, just some of the games they're playing with order and, like, the chronology of these things happen in. And I don't think either, like, the movie chronology or the musical chronology seems inappropriate. And it's just, like, they've played... You know, they put all the post-it notes of the scene on a of the movie on a board and then rearranged them a whole bunch. And it doesn't drastically affect a lot of things. But it is interesting to me that they did the thing. Like the It's Hip to Be Square murder scene happens so early in the movie. And I know it as the end of Act One in the musical. And it was like, I paused the movie to see where we were at, and it was like a quarter of the way or maybe a third of the way into the movie. And I was like, where are they going to go from here? But a bunch of stuff from the musical that had already happened by then just hadn't happened yet in the movie. And I do find that interesting from a structural standpoint, because it kind of works both ways, which I think speaks to like how unimportant the specifics of some of these murder scenes are. Which I think speaks to some of the larger structural problems with the musical, that like, it doesn't really matter. Like, it is interesting where the movie and the musical both put Patrick inviting Gene over, because it is it's a much bigger deal in the musical, I think, than it is in the movie, because it's later, if I'm remembering things right.
Yes, it's pretty much the... like the denouement,
right? Whereas in the movie, it's about halfway through, maybe. It's like,
yeah,
like, you know, we don't see a lot of gruesome murders before that, certainly before the chainsaw scene. And so it paints a different Patrick Bateman maybe in both of them, and I think the musical one is perhaps a little less successful.
It's tricky. So the musical actually follows the book a bit more,
really.
But what the book does is, you know, Patrick's killing people from the second chapter.
Right.
And he just does it willy-nilly throughout the book. Like, it's not as beated.
Yeah.
As it is in either the film or the musical. I guess the musical kind of gets around it in Killing Spree.
Yeah.
Where he's just, you know, just killing lots of people. Right. And that's... their way of saying.
I do get a sense, and this is only, I haven't read the book, but I've read a couple synopses. I do get the sense that both the musical and the movie play with, like, revealing the information to the audience piecemeal. Like, oh, he brought in this pillowcase with maybe a cranberry juice stain on it, and we haven't quite seen him murder anyone yet. And, like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And, like, certainly the beginning started with what we assume is blood in the movie, but actually ends up being... you know, strawberry topping on whatever dessert. And like, there's a bunch of foreshadowing before it's like, oh, is he killing people? Do I know he's killing people? Where, and correct me if I'm wrong, but my assumption is in the book, it seems much more early where they're like, yep, he's killing people. He's just killing people.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, but then I think it's just the length of the different.
Yeah. The different media
things.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah, because the first big kill with the homeless person in the musical, the homeless person in the film, and the homeless person in the book, was the first like heavily described,
Like to the kill. To the audience,
Yeah, but he's, I think by that time of the book, he's already done his, like, screaming into people's faces, being like, I want to slice off your skin. Like, right. That kind of malarkey.
Yeah, so that's already happened. So maybe that does mirror. Interesting.
Yeah. That's the thing. Like, if you'd read the book first,
mm-hmm.
you would never understand how they could make this into
yeah.
any other piece of fiction.
Yeah. It's really interesting, because I have experienced this piece of media 100% backwards, right?
Yeah, uh-huh, Philly. Yeah,
musical
yeah, yeah,
movie,
funny.
And then haven't read the book. And like, I don't know, in the world we live in the musical theater world, I find that interesting just as a concept, because like the poor dads who were dragged to Mean Girls the musical, because it's on my mind, for the first time, and like had never seen the movie, and yeah. how do they experience that piece of art differently than the moms and the daughters who dragged them there?
For sure.
And like, you know, finding the balance in our particular art form, which is built off of adaptation, of yeah. like serving the adapted work while also being true to the art form and making it new and interesting and appropriate for your medium.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good, but I've never really thought of it like that. But I don't know, if I kind of look at the musical on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And separate it from all the other pieces.
Yeah.
I feel it would just be awful.
Yeah. No, I think that's the problem. I think this musical is kind of caught between itself. Mm. And if it had just given in to any of the three directions, like
yep.
screw the book and the movie, we're going to be our own musical, or screw the movie, we're going to be true to the book, or screw the book, we're going to be an exact representation of the movie, it yeah. would have succeeded more. But because yeah. it tried to like Venn diagram it all into one perfect center, it just ended up being like atonal and mismatched and not cohesive.
Totally. 100%. That is exactly it. But yeah, we still love it.
Yeah.
What's that?
Bizarrely.
So bizarre. Yeah.
December slides into January, which mutates into February, which creeps towards March. There is a theory that obliterating Paul might have satisfied something, but no. I've continued to have intense dreams about vivisection. My nightly bloodlust continues to overflow.
Hey pretty girl, do you wanna dance? Do you wanna get lucky? Well this is your chance, the drinks are on me. Can I be frank? I'm doing quite well in my investment bank. What do you do? What do you do for a living? No, don't answer that, I don't care, I'm just kidding. You can ignore my friends at the bar, they're trying to score, but they never get far.
So Tommy, of course this episode is sponsored by Gold Star.
Gold Star! Gold Star has a great selection of live events, affordable tickets, and terrific customer service. And most of Gold Star's tickets can be changed or cancelled if your plans change. Did you know that, Jimmy?
I did know that. How great is that? Yeah, so we asked you last week that if you used our promo code HAPPYHOUR to give us a shout out about what you got, and we had some people, Tommy, people have been using it.
I am so happy, one, that like I'm hearing about people going to see theater, but two, that like we're able to help them with, you know, our fun little promo code here.
Exactly. It's so easy. Like, it's one of those things. I think most local productions, if you're in the States, sorry, yeah. UK, but most local productions are on it anyway, so if you are planning on going to see something, just use the code and get some money off. But we had Suzanne Jensen, who went to see Once on This Island Sings Aarons and Flaherty at 54 Below.
Which sounds so much fun.
So good. I'm so jealous.
Right? And Catherine Cries in Public Hope went to go see Puffs, or is going to go see Puffs next month. That's that Harry Potter Hufflepuff parody thing.
Perfect. I love awesome. It. Do you know what Puffs is in the UK?
I don't know if we're allowed to talk about it in an ad read.
Lol. No, it's like a crisp.
Ah, not what I was going to guess. Yes. If you use the promo code HAPPYHOUR at goldstar.com or on the Gold Star app, you get $10 off your purchase. And remember, most tickets on Gold Star are already about 50% off.
Exactly. There's just no reason not to. So you get $10 off your first order by using the promo code HAPPYHOUR at goldstar.com/happyhour.
Go do it. Enjoy some theater. Buy some tickets.
Absolutely.
And then tell us what you went to see and how it was, because that's really what we care about. Is people,
yeah, it's always quite intriguing.
Theater. Yeah.
It's quite intriguing to see what people are getting,
right?
up to.
Like, and they have such a fantastic selection of things. Like, you never know what you're going to find.
Absolutely. So, yeah, let us know.
And thanks, Gold Star, for sponsoring.
Oh, this is rich. I shouldn't say, but this guy at work is totally gay. And that's all cool, to each his own. Some guy's ass is not what I bone. Let's roll, let's go back to my place. And after a party, I can eat your face. Don't be nervous, invite your friends. The night is young, but it all depends.
We love it so much. Why can't we go see it right now?
Well, so this was popular on the West End. Like, people liked this show, right?
It sold out very, very quickly. I think, am I getting it mixed up with Groundhog Day? I don't know. I think it sold out before its run even began.
Yeah.
Because of Matt Smith. And because of Duncan Sheik.
Okay.
And because of American Psycho.
Yeah.
Like, its name propelled it.
Yeah, big
it
brand
didn't
appeal.
Propel itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it wasn't reviewed well.
Interesting.
At all.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a bunch of reasons. I think one of the biggest things, and I didn't know this until I started reading up, but it originally was going to transfer off-Broadway.
Off-Broadway, yeah.
But I don't know if a theater opened up or they got an influx of money or what. But they decided to skip off Broadway and just jump straight to Broadway.
Yeah,
and I think that was I like squarely think that was a mistake.
Totally. It really doesn't make, it doesn't make any sense, because after London, they knew they had to do a lot of rewrite.
Right. Yes.
And it has been heavily rewritten between London and Broadway. So it's quite interesting that they then didn't, you know.
Yeah.
Have like, an off-Broadway run where they could try it to...
Have a half workshop, like...
Yeah.
In a smaller house with cheaper tickets. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's also that kind of show, like, it wouldn't be weird, you know? It wouldn't be like SpongeBob off-Broadway.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. It would fit in a small house.
But they just didn't do it. I think it's hubris.
Yeah.
I think it has to be, because there's no... I've yet to see a reason
mm-hmm.
other than... Oh, it just didn't happen.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. I've been kind of trolling through some old tweets of the time, and I don't have, like, for some musical theater authors in my head, for better or for worse, I have like a what I feel is a pretty accurate representation of their personality in my brain. Like, I bet you I could do a character study. I have done a character study on Stephen Sondheim, an inaccurate one, but. Nonetheless.
A great accent, though.
Thank
Flawless.
You. But, like, I feel that way about a lot of musical theater authors. I don't feel that way about Duncan Sheik. I can't tell him, you know, I can't read him very well.
Okay, interesting.
But I found a tweet from him right around when American Psycho was closing.
Yep.
And he said, the truth is, American Psycho the musical is for the cool kids, which is not to say traditional musical theater goers won't like it, but the fact remains. Yep. And... I feel the hubris there.
Yeah, he's he's damn dirty full of himself, but yeah. Like, yeah, it's fine.
Right. Like you should be proud of your stuff, but
yeah, totally. He's like, Duncan Sheik is very much like a musician first.
Yes.
Kind of storyteller. So we talked a bit about this when we did Spring.
Yeah.
Way back when. That was ages ago, by the way. Because we talked about with Spring, like the way that he writes songs,
mm-hmm.
they're extremely poetic, extremely yeah. metaphorical. And he doesn't apologize for that.
Right.
And I think that's just Duncan Sheik's kind of thing. Like, I've listened to quite a lot of his own music, just his own pop music.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's a big Jeff Buckley fan. I'm yeah. a big Jeff Buckley fan, and I like people yeah. who like Jeff Buckley. And it's totally got the vibe. Like, you can hear
yeah.
Spring Awakening in his music, or yeah. I guess vice versa.
I do think with something like Spring Awakening, which feels like that story can be unabashedly poetic and heightened throughout the entire thing,
yeah.
and it is appropriate for the story. In American Psycho, like, we hit, what, 3-4 songs in, "Oh, baby, baby, you're such a card.
Yeah.
You make it seem so easy, but it's oh so fucking hard.
Yeah.
Oh, baby, baby." Like, nothing, yeah. nothing happens in this song. And I get that it is a popular scene in the movie, and I imagine an important scene in the book, and we need to put a song here, right?
Yeah.
But we don't end the song anywhere near where we began it. And we should. We should see Patrick Bateman getting angrier or more peeved or putting on a face more or something, right?
Yeah.
We should use this as an opportunity to build this character who is at the middle of this piece. But instead, it's like a novelty number in a show that really doesn't deserve novelty numbers.
Exactly. And again, this is one of the other, because I feel it's the same with Mistletoe.
Yeah.
Kind of the same with Hard Body.
Yeah. I mean, I feel it's even the same with You Are What You Wear, which I adore, which I really enjoy. And like,
yeah.
we're establishing what women are in this world. And like, we already met all the men. We have to meet the women. But it's not, nothing happens. Nothing happens. It's a list song.
Yeah. But so, what I think here is this is a very tricky thing to do with the source material, because in the source material, nothing happens.
Yeah.
Like, you'll be sat for chapter upon chapter of lists
right.
of what people are wearing. Like, there's literally one chapter where he goes through about 8 different people and lists every single item of clothing that they're wearing. Or you'll be reading a menu, like they do in the musical.
And tell you everything about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is weird. You Are What You Wear isn't jarring to me, because it could literally be a scene in the book. It's not, but it could be.
Right. But that's where I think, like, this is why it is interesting the order we approach these medias in. Because just because it is an accurate representation of the book does not make it an appropriate song for the musical. You know what I mean?
For sure. But what do you not think it heightens that kind of vapid, like, these characters are empty as shit?
I think it's one of the better songs in the show.
Yeah.
To be honest. But I think it is also emblematic of this, like, low-grade hubris that runs throughout Duncan Sheik's music.
Interesting.
Like, that, like, you will understand this song or not, and I don't care. Like, I watch that song, and it's entertaining, and I hear people enjoy it, and I don't think they get it, right? I don't think they're where you are with it, and, like, right there with the vapidness of all these people. Like, ha-ha, they're naming all these clothing brands that I recognize, and they're projecting it behind it, and then they're doing these weird dance moves. How exciting!
Yeah.
You know, oh, man, this is great. And now I know this joke must be funny, because they delivered it like this, and then they turned their face to the audience at the moment. That must be the punchline, Manolo Blahnik. Like, but it's not really a punchline if you don't understand it. You're just, like, getting the telegraph that, like, this is a laugh. And I personally think good musical theater should cater to a dumber audience. To put it very bluntly. Like, if people don't understand your art, then your art is less successful.
But then, what do you think about with something like Spring?
I think spring is more accessible. I really do.
I mean,
because it lives more squarely in the clouds of metaphor, because you don't need to understand the explicit words. Like, your assumption of what they're saying and what they look like is appropriate for the meaning that's behind it, even if you're not quite getting the deeply intentional metaphoric artistic words behind it, right? But the tone of "you are what you wear" and the intent and meaning behind "you are what you wear" are disparate from each other, right? "You are what you wear" with earmuffs on or in a foreign language is a fun poppy techno song, right? Yep. The concept of "you are what you wear" is like this really sardonic critique of consumerist society, which doesn't like match the dance moves when they're saying, you know, Peggy Johnson. That's not her name. That's not what it is.
Betsy Johnson.
You know, like that mismatch there doesn't read. It doesn't match. It's not
fair enough.
It's not far enough away and clear enough. And I think explicitly in "You Are What You Wear," but throughout the whole thing, a lot of it, you know, because it is a, you know, it's a high art concept piece in its construction, in its costume, in its set design, in its music, in its choreography. And it's a high art concept piece based on a cult classic movie. And like, we may watch American Psycho and go into it and be like, look at all this allegory, but not everyone does. And so there are people coming to see this who love the movie because it's a black comedy, and like, they're, you know, reading in certain things. I don't mean to say that like dumb people watch American Psycho, but like, it is foolish to say something like this musical is for the cool kids. It is foolish and hubristic to like bolster yourself up with that. You have to find the middle ground between appeasing the unwashed masses while still staying true to your artistic allegorical roots. The most successful artists can do both at the same time.
I think that tweet, you know, I can't remember exactly where it came in relation to it closing.
It was like,
I think it's like right after.
It was either right before or right after. The wound was still fresh, so I will absolutely give any artist the benefit of the doubt, right?
Totally. But it's interesting though, because like in terms of the actual songs in the show, my favorite ones and the ones that I think work and the ones that I would want to see more of are the like high art allegorical so songs like Killing Time, songs like Not a Common Man, or but this is not an exit. At the end, like these ones where they're very poetic again, you know, talking about thematic things, I think work a lot better in the show because they kind of just sit above it. Whereas the songs that are like action songs, so things like Cards, or things like Mistletoe Alert, I think are pish because they're story propellers as opposed to let's talk about what we're talking about and what you're watching here,
right?
And I just don't think that suits American Psycho
as a
piece of fiction.
That's true.
Because it's never about the plot.
No, it's never about the plot. It's never about what's happening. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as we talked earlier, I do think that is a symptom of, like, trying to live in between all three of these mediums
instead of
squarely sitting in one. I do think, so, This Is Not an Exit is something that sticks out to me and something I wanted to talk about. And the concept of an anti-hero and whether the audience pities them or sympathizes with them. The comparison I keep drawing in my mind with this musical is Sweeney Todd.
Of course.
The original horror slasher musical, which is squarely Brechtian in its design and its conceit. Like, you are watching this story happen. And by the end of, you know, attend the tale of Sweeney Todd. Basically, yep. Pity Sweeney Todd. Pity these poor people who, you know, pity Mrs. Lovett, who could not get what she wanted. Pity Sweeney Todd, who could not get what he wanted. Like, pity these poor, flawed characters from afar. You do not empathize with them. You pity them. You feel bad that they existed. Which I felt in the movie. Like, I pity Patrick Bateman. You know, I feel a thing about his struggle.
Yeah.
I think it's wrong. I think he's still an awful person. But, like, I gain a little more understanding of his psyche.
Yeah.
I think one of the huge traps that the musical falls into is it pushes you a little more towards the sympathy end of the spectrum with Patrick Bateman. That, like, you're like, oh, I understand where you're coming from.
Totally.
And, like, I think, you know, don't understand where he's coming from. He's a psycho. It's in the title. Like, but I think that is one of the other glaring plot problems that is a culmination of a musical's worth of songs.
Yeah. I think, like, I do, I totally agree with you. And I think a lot of that comes from putting Gene a lot more in the center of the spotlight.
Yeah.
And putting his mother into the story. Like, you're getting all of these other sides of Patrick's character.
Yeah,
make you be like, ah.
Right. You're humanizing him, and he should not be humanized.
Exactly. It's just, that's just not the point.
Yeah.
Of any of it. Because that last chapter, the last moment in the film, the last moment in the musical, well, not really. It's the song, but it doesn't. Yeah, I guess it's a bit different. But, like, so the book ends with the line, "This is not an exit," and the film ends with
the
sign
him.
Over his shoulder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because that is really kind of what it's about, the idea that he's almost living in this hell.
Yeah.
What do you call that?
Purgatory.
Purgatory,
It's squarely, isn't it a Sartre play, No Exit?
No Exit.
The four people trapped in a room that ends up being purgatory. Like, it's a super literary reference.
What I think is it's to imply that almost, it's that, like, Sisyphean thing of you're going to have to go through this again and again and again. And it takes you away from all of the human aspect of it.
Yeah.
Because he now becomes this kind of archetype.
Right.
Or this kind of avatar for anything.
Yeah.
And I think, but what I think This Is Not an Exit does well is that it hits home that, I'm not me, I'm not anyone.
Right.
This is just what my representation of being Patrick Bateman is.
This is what Patrick Bateman means to me. Yeah.
Means to me. And that's, again, that's how the book ends, is that line.
Even though it's
a musical.
I think. No, you go. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, with Sweeney Todd, the comparison can be kind of extended further, because in the finale of Sweeney Todd, you've got, no one can hurt, nothing can hide you. Isn't that Sweeney there beside you?
Yeah.
And this idea of, like, Sweeney sits in the parlor wall. He's everywhere because he's everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's in everyone.
Yeah.
That idea. And I think American Psycho tries to kind of relay that as well, is that this is all, we're all kind of, we have our own Patrick Batemans.
Yeah. I mean, it's explicitly in the plot, too. In all three versions, about the, like, mistaken identity and, like, misrecognizing someone for someone else. And in a way, we're like, all these businessmen are exactly the same. All of their business cards look exactly the same. Like, they are just cookie cutter versions of each other and are each their own American Psycho. And who knows what else they get up to in the quiet hours of the night. And that's why the realtor is like, you have to leave, because this is the 16th filled with dead bodies apartments we've had to deal with this week, all you American Psychos living around here. Or not, or was it all in his head?
But that's, you know, I mean, when the lawyer's like, I just had dinner with Paulo, and he could be talking about Edgar Halberstam, he could be talking about Tim Price,
like, or Patrick could have totally mistaken someone else for Paul Owen all night and accidentally killed the wrong person.
That's exactly it, because none of them ever know, really. You know, they hear rumblings that Paul Owen scored the Fisher's account, but it's, you know, I mean, it's always just that, oh, who did that? Oh, I don't know. I think it was this person. Oh, look, there's Thingy over there. Who's he with? Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're constantly dipped into this confusion world.
Yeah.
That is yuppie culture in New York in the 80s, you know, where everyone was aspiring to be the exact same thing. Yeah.
But it does very much make it seem like the perfect way to tell this story is through the book, and that the movie and the musical are representations that bring it to a wider audience, but because you actualize them with visuals, it removes a whole nother layer to this story. I think the musical even more so than the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, like, I think actually... musical theater is a great place for American Psycho, but you just need to take it completely differently. And I think this is where I almost kind of agree with Duncan Sheik.
Mm-hmm.
It would never work. It would never get on Broadway, but I don't think that's where this is supposed to be.
No, because this would have done better off Broadway. Yeah.
Yeah. Or just wherever, like just as a piece that you saw in, you know, Detroit.
Yeah.
Like who knows? Because it is highbrow. Like, it is highbrow at the end of the day. It talks about big things.
Yeah.
And it asks you to suspend your disbelief. Like, you're not going to get answers.
Yeah.
And you have to be okay with that.
Yeah.
Which you get a lot in straight theatre.
Right.
You don't get a lot in musical theatre.
Yeah. I do.
And so I think... Mm-hmm. Well, I just think American Psycho, therefore, could actually be a great piece that branches out into this new kind of era of musical theater.
Yeah. And this was
like
so
highbrow.
This was so close. There's an early interview with Bret Easton Ellis, who seems to have been very involved in the writing process, which you don't often see in this kind of relationship. And it's like, I think it might even be pre-West End, like still when they're writing it, or it like an old, they had a Kickstarter too. Like there's a bunch of old media about this. But he talks about how he thinks the character of Patrick Bateman might be more suited to a musical because he views himself as larger than life. Mm-hmm. And that really resonated with me. And it was very specifically talking about like his enjoyment but slight distaste for the movie. Like in a world of close-ups and answers and zoom-ins on the eyeballs, you can't have a kick line or a big dance number. Like, you can't have these gigantic things that are how Patrick Bateman views his life. And the musical certainly delves into some of those things.
Yeah, it skims the surface, but I think it could crash in a lot. Like, I would love to just go see a really, like, misty, heady...
Yeah.
Look at this where I leave feeling so confused and disturbed.
Yeah.
And again, it bums me out. Like, a lot of the reviews go into it being like, it's not horrific enough.
Mm-hmm.
You only get this one scene. The thing is, at the end of the day, you can't have a scene where a rat is eating a woman's parts.
No.
Do you know what I mean? On a stage, you can't actually have that.
It's gross and also not interesting. Like, it's wrong on both levels. Like, it's indecent and inappropriate literally for the stage, but also, like... It doesn't advance the plot. Like, it would just look silly in the moment.
So what I think the musical then should do is kind of curve around that idea and just eat into the allegory and just really just delve into that. Like, take it, like we said before, like, take it as its own thing.
Yeah.
Because, and I do think that Duncan Sheik would be a great person to write it.
Yeah.
Because he's good at that. Like, he is good at letting you think through a song and interpret it how you wish. And there are those moments, like, Killing Time, This Is Not an Exit, Not a Common Man, like, these where he's very good at giving you breathing space to think about things. I don't know, but you do. The other thing is you do need the violence. The violence is very important.
It's really important. You need the blood. You need the
Well, it's just like because in the book, you know, by the time you get round to the rat scene, I don't think the rat isn't in the film, is it?
I don't think so. No,
I don't think it is. It's horrific. It's probably the most horrific thing I've ever read.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time you get there, you're so desensitized,
right,
that you read it as if it's, you know, a Harry Potter chapter. Like, it's really impressive the way that he just, like, kind of nulls you.
Yeah.
As you're reading the book.
Yeah.
And, like, that just comes through all of this shock, all of this violence.
Yeah.
So to try and, I don't know, to bring that into the musical somehow.
Yeah.
To get to that stage.
To get some of that, you know, desensitization.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you would do it, yeah, but that's what it needs.
Yeah.
Because it's not scary, it's funny.
Yeah, right.
Like, all of the killing moments, they're not scary at all.
No.
Because it's very difficult to do. It's very, right, difficult to do.
It's very difficult to do. And that's the thing that, if we're talking about the comparison with Sweeney Todd, like, all of the murders in Sweeney Todd are scary. They are so gruesome and scary.
Depends on your production.
Like, it depends on your production, true. But, like, yeah, as intended, you know, there is... And I think it is... Maybe that's a problem. It's harder to make chopping someone's head off with an axe to Huey Lewis in the news as appropriately terrifying as it needs to be.
Yeah.
You know?
But again, though, by that point, you're really numb.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, in the book, that's like two-thirds through.
Yeah, interesting.
You're numb at that point. So it's... Yeah. I don't know. I just feel so like... Ha! Yeah. So close.
Yeah. It's kind of, I mean, I bet it's the sort of thing where it also might have just been the wrong season. I bet you if American Psycho was this year, it would have swept. Like,
well, this is it. Like,
because yeah, we're talking, so this is the 70th Tony Awards. This is 2016. This is Hamilton year.
This is Hamilton year.
Which was also a gigantic year. Everyone forgets that, like, Waitress opened that year. School of Rock, yeah, opened that year. You know.
But then it's one of those things, it was only nominated for lighting.
Yeah, lighting, it was two, it was lighting and, hold on, I can find it. Scenic.
Right. Do you know what I mean? And because of the projection, like, great, well done. Right. Like, the projections are great.
Yeah, and the lighting's, sure, great. And they're, you know, they're great.
Yeah, but to be honest, even if it was this season, I still don't think the material is good enough yet,
yeah,
that it would have done well. I don't, like... That's the thing. It's just, I love it as like my problematic cousin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's that thing that it's like, oh, it could just be so good and I can see its potential.
Mm-hmm.
I understand why everyone else would hate them.
Right.
But I'm like, I'm really rooting for you.
Yeah. And it's also sad because in the world of musical theater, we'll probably never see another American Psycho. Do you think it's going to be revived or put up somewhere?
So that there's talks. It was certainly the talks were last year,
uh-huh,
but there were talks about bringing it back to the West End again,
really,
after some more rewrites. Yeah, okay. But I just don't know. I think, like, sorry, Roberto, but I think you need to leave the project and someone else needs to take it up.
That's unfortunate.
Because
yeah,
it doesn't need to be a book musical.
Yeah.
Like, you need.
Just go full on Spring Awakening with it. Yeah. And like Roberto writes smart stuff, but his stuff is, there's a reason they brought him in to fix Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark.
Yeah.
Like, make it into a family friendly theme park style comic book piece that was still clever and smart and funny.
Absolutely. Like, he's a big horror fan, yeah, and I think that's why they brought him in.
Yeah.
Cause he wrote the recent Carrie movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
The 2013, but whatever that was.
You know, I've just had this thought, but I don't think this is a horror story. I think it is a slasher story, but it doesn't have the kind of, like... Because if we're talking in broad strokes about a horror movie or a horror genre, yeah, like, I'm never particularly scared of Patrick Bateman. Or mm-hmm, I'm never particularly scared for the prostitute that he's chasing down the hallway.
Yep.
I'm, you know, not in that horror kind of way.
Yeah, you don't have that peril moment. Because
right,
the thing is you're not really rooting for anyone in
no,
the fiction.
And so that seems like a misstep.
Yeah.
Some of the more horror conventions that made it into the musical.
Yeah. I think that's it. They've just tried to make it a big musical,
yeah,
but it's not, it's something else.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It needs a a Ghost Quartet treatment or something. Do you know what I mean? Just
something,
like,
something super funky and out of left field.
Yeah, big old stramash of ideas.
Yeah.
Like, I'm into that.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Who knows? But yeah, so I don't know if this West End one is going to happen.
Yeah.
I would love it.
Yeah.
Because I'd also just love to see it in the flesh at some point. But I don't know. Yeah. I've not heard any rumbling since their initial rumbling.
That may make a fantastic opportunity for a transition, because I do
That's why I was trying to hit home the point.
Talk with you about the differences between the West End version and the Broadway version.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSMusical.com.
This one struck me a lot, and I'm going to use some bad words here.
It's all right. They use it in the musical?
In
and everything?
In the West End version, on the cast recording, when Patrick is sleeping with Courtney, I don't know what song this piece of dialogue is attached
to. It's in Hard Body.
It's in Hard Body. Yeah. Patrick is about to call Lewis something, and Courtney says, "Don't call him a faggot."
Yep.
Because he is a closeted homosexual, and it's the 80s. This is an appropriate shock-filled term for this moment. Appropriate's the wrong word, but like time period appropriate, right?
Yeah.
For their characters. They changed that to Broadway, and she says, "Don't call him queer." And I found this... like, this really sideswiped me, and I found it kind of jarring that they had downgraded from the, you know, homophobic term faggot to the homophobic term queer to describe Lewis in this homophobic moment.
Yeah.
It really took a lot of the air out of it for me, and then I, like the pendulum swung in my head and was like, but no, we should never be okay with the word faggot on stage. But then I was like, but it's appropriate in this moment, and I really didn't know how to feel. And then I also thought, like, who in the transition team from the West End to Broadway was like, you got to cut the F word there. Like,
but what that confuses me more is they keep it in Killing Spree,
right,
when he's talking to Gene, I think. He's like, I had to kill some fag dog and his fag owner.
Where it's also, that's the only place you see it in the movie as well. I imagine this is an assumption that it's more present in the book.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure they cut it out more for the movie because, you know, it's a movie.
Yeah, but it's strange that it wasn't an all or nothing.
Right, like...
like, are they like, oh, Courtney needs to be nicer? Like, yeah. She wouldn't use that word.
Yeah, like, and like, at that point, I wish she had just said, don't call him a homo, because... and like, granted, we're like 2016. Like, I think, and certainly up for debate, but we are well on our way towards retaking the word queer in that moment. And like... This is the interesting discussion. Like, queer was almost certainly as equally an offensive term in the 1980s, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could probably toss either around and get the same meaning about in that time. But the reason you're removing faggot from the show isn't because it's inappropriate for the 80s. It's because you don't want to shock your 2016 audience. And so then inserting the word queer, which is probably pretty normalized among a 2016 audience, seems like the wrong writing choice.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. It really struck me.
Yeah, I do find it. I always find weird tiny bits like that.
Yeah,
strange, because it's not the like the generally the only reason I can think is that they were like worried about Courtney's character.
Yeah,
but she's so underwritten in the musical anyway that it's like,
who cares?
Why you fuss, mate?
Like, yeah, and she's saying something that like clearly Patrick has said before too. It's not even from her brain.
Yeah, exactly. It's not her opinion. She actively doesn't think he is
right. But I don't know. I found this. It's a topic that has been in the back of my mind for a while. Like the use of specifically the word faggot, but also a lot of like outdated terminology in pieces from the time. And like, especially in this sort of world where like we're not supposed to sympathize with any of these characters, but do you change it to reflect contemporary sensibilities, or do you keep it to be true to the time period you're attempting to represent?
Yeah, you keep it. I just think 100% you keep it true, because, like, you know, if you were doing if you were writing Ragtime today, you wouldn't not include the N word.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you know what I mean? You couldn't, and that would be an insult to the people that fought to reclaim that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And to fight against that, because you need to. It's that thing. It's like you need to see how bad it was.
Right. It's representation
in order to see how you've moved on.
Yeah.
It's not, and again as well, like they're not looking at into the audience like you're all a bunch of it's you know, it's all within the text. So I think 100% it's representative of the time.
Yeah,
totally.
Do you think, I mean, we've talked about this a bunch of times, like with Hamilton and with a couple other like Amero-centric plots.
Mm-hmm.
Like a West End audience seeing American Psycho is different than a New York audience seeing American Psycho. Specifically, our quiz question, like the fact that a lady in the front row brought her designer purse and was angry that the fake blood got splattered on it in this musical filled with vapid people bringing their designer purses everywhere who don't want to spill red wine on them
to the musical theater. Yeah,
yeah. Like the irony there is overwhelming. But like, I wonder, like, I also wonder if that's a problem with it flopping on Broadway. Like, if it would have been better even in, like, Chicago. But because this is New York, and it is kind of like, hey, New York, look at you feeling, maybe that contributed to it, some of its success in the West End?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, the yuppie culture that will be, and I guess... we hadn't had the Hamilton boom yet, because the Hamilton boom was currently happening.
Yeah.
Like, the yuppie culture that before the teens took over, now, they were the ones that were attending the theatre all the time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's a very kind of stark look at that.
Yeah.
You know, they talk about Les Mis every five pages in the book. And, you know, they go to see it in the music. You know, it's... They don't shy away from the fact that it's like, hey,
yeah,
this is you.
Well, in the book, they don't. I wonder if in the musical they do. Because they know who their audience is, right? And they kind of hide it in that, like, more satire feeling. Like, this is a ridiculous portrayal of a rich New Yorker. This couldn't possibly be true. Because they know the yuppies are coming to see the show. And they saw the matinee of Les Mis last week.
Exactly.
Like, it's why I wonder, like, they need... Don't put the blood screen down and splatter the blood on everyone's fancy dresses. Like, if that's what they're going to do, it's very... Are they the futurists? The ones who, like, would put fresh paint on the... auditorium chairs before the audience came just to mess with them. I think I have that theater history right. Like, go for it. If that's the point, if that's the reason you're doing the show is because you're passionate about this message and you're passionate about this story, then it's like, it's theater. There's a reason there's a live audience. Dive into it. Use it. Do it. But I feel like some of the tonal shifts of it, some of the differences between the movie and the musical shy away from that reality.
Yeah, I think so. It's slowly but surely becoming squeaky clean.
Yeah.
And it's not a piece of fiction that you can do that to.
Yeah.
You know?
Which is unfortunate.
It's not squeaky clean because it's looking at the horrible people.
Right. But it just seems distant and separate now, where the point is that this is not an allegory. This is reality.
Yeah. The kind of interesting point of, like, you're talking about, like, a mirror centric and comparing it to Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting one because on the West End, I would say on the West End,
mm-hmm.
it was more well received than Broadway.
Okay.
Like, there are more people, I would say, who want to go back to that theater as opposed to going back to.
Mm-hmm.
See the Broadway version.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, interesting.
And I do kind of wonder, is that a contribute, you know, I mean, is that a part of the whole, oh, you're talking about New Yorkers.
Right.
But the West End lot see it more for you're what talking, it is.
Right. Or does it let you, if you're on West End, it lets you view it more from afar? Like, you're talking about Americans right now and their consumerist tendencies. Not that I don't think these things exist all across the world, but there's a reason it's American Psycho.
Totally. But I mean, as well, I guess the 80s was one of the biggest times of the UK and the US coming together.
Yeah. But like, but it's not,
everyone was rich.
But it's not, you know, London Psycho.
American right. Psycho in London.
Yeah, exactly. The sequel.
That's funny. But yeah, totally. But I think... You know, with your Wall Street, we have our Canary Wharf.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the parallels. Do you know what I mean? We have the same people.
Yeah.
But I also think,
mm-hmm.
and I'm very up for having a sparring match, but I think West End audiences are used to seeing stuff a bit more highbrow than a Broadway audience.
I think I would begrudgingly agree.
Yep.
I wish it was different.
Yeah. Now, what I don't mean by that is I don't mean the musical theater audience.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think it's the complete opposite. And I've talked about that before.
Yeah.
Like, the West End's off. It's a theme park.
Right.
And Broadway, sadly, seems to be heading that
direction very squarely.
Yep. So I think, Broadway audiences would be more up for seeing a bit of art, but the theatre going, like, the play audiences,
mm-hmm.
the straight theatre audiences in the West End,
yeah,
you know, are they're fine to watch anything.
Yeah. What,
and the kind of the wankier.
That kind of also makes me wonder, which is something we haven't talked about. Like, what if this was just a play? Like,
yeah.
If it was a play adaptation of American Psycho, it had the full soundtrack that the movie and the book has, had no songs.
Yep.
I bet you it would have done pretty okay. I don't think plays nowadays do very well, generally speaking.
Well, they certainly don't make nearly as much money.
Right. And so, you know, there's problems in there too. But at least as a piece of theater literature.
Yeah.
The musicalization of it seems almost, not entirely, but almost inappropriate.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, there's times when I say completely, and those times are mistletoe cards.
Yeah.
But there are times when I think, oh no, it needs to be a musical.
Yeah.
Because, two reasons.
Mm-hmm.
One, the Bret Easton Ellis argument of it allows you to come out.
Right, it lets you just go so deep into it, yeah.
Yep. The other one being, music is so important to the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, music is such a huge feature of it.
Yeah.
So the songs that they cover and rearrange in the musical are fantastic, and they paint the era.
Yeah.
You know, they take these iconic songs.
And they did a good, like, good on the creators for, you know, getting the rights to Don't You Want Me, putting in Hip to Be Square, like, you know, it's the problem with, it's not going to go anywhere, but First Wives Club, the musical, didn't get the rights to You Don't Own Me.
Well...
Like, why would you go see it, right? Like, you have to get those rights first before you go into it. But
totally,
it, like, high on the list of good moves by, you know, Roberto and Duncan.
Yeah, definitely. And the arrangements that Duncan Sheik has done of this are fantastic. Like, the In the Air Tonight one. So we actually performed that is with our choir.
Uh-huh.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
He's everyone's favorite of the night.
Yeah.
Because it's just so, everyone knows the song.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do kind of get blindsided, like, oh, wait, oh, it's this one.
Oh,
it's right.
Different. Yeah.
Yeah. Or and they use it really well.
Even just the you know, subtle sound design stuff they do with Hip to Be Square at the end of Act One, and like how it gets this dark tone to it.
Totally.
Super theatrical, super appropriate, exactly what it needs. You know, and it does, I don't know, it kind of makes, this is why I think early on when we were talking, I said, like, Duncan Sheik's theme and style for the music for this sort of thing is appropriate for the time period. I think the thing I didn't say was it seems a little less appropriate for the musical, because the music that's in this show that isn't from the time period is not the kind of music that Patrick Bateman listens to.
Give me examples.
Anything he sings is not this kind of... Because, like, while we're in the 80s, and a lot of Duncan Sheik's music would fit squarely in the 80s, not a lot of it sounds like Phil Collins. Not a lot of it sounds like Huey Lewis in the News.
Right, but he also listens to Whitney Houston.
Right, but not a lot of it sounds like Whitney Houston.
But as in, I think the idea is that Patrick Bateman is just a culture absorber.
Yeah, okay.
Do you know what I mean? So I think if it's good and it's popular,
he'll
know everything about it.
Yeah.
And I think there are lots of songs in this that are extremely new wave.
Yeah.
And yeah, do sound like they've just been patched straight from the 80s. Like Killing Spree.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Incred. Yeah.
Widgermajigger Bob, Majigger Lujigi, Bumbly.
My favorite song.
Yep. Killing Time.
Killing Time.
I've already talked about it 20,000 times. Again, like, very, has that really deep new wave club sound.
Yeah.
That you can see. I do think there are exceptions.
Yes.
Mistletoe.
Yeah.
End of an Island.
Yeah.
Don't know what they're doing in there. But that's all right.
Yeah,
but then I guess End of an Island has that kind of like stereotypical we're on holiday sound. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know.
Mistletoe, I just hate.
Yeah, no. It's really also, it is interesting, especially watching the movie, having seen the musical first. Yeah. Just like the singular lines that are expanded into entire songs.
Full songs, I know.
It's like, wow, we were really reaching for something to turn into a song there, weren't we?
Well, sometimes he does it really well. Like the, For This Is Not an Exit.
I think that's a great example. Yeah.
Not a Common Man as well. Yeah. Like,
Patrick
has this beautiful little monologue where he talks about that, and it, the way they expand that out, is quite cool.
Yeah.
And obviously the morning routine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a beautiful way to open this show. I do think it is, for a contemporary audience, this is maybe the most cohesive example of the misstep. Like, the difference between what listening to the unadulterated cast recording and watching a bootleg of the opening number.
I would never do that.
Ever. I never do that, especially for shows that have closed. When you listen to it on the cast recording, it is interesting, a little funny, a little scary, right? And then the bass line comes in, msip, I'm Patrick Bateman. Like, you know, when you watch other people watching it and they find it hilarious that Patrick Bateman is really excited about his television with picture-in-picture capabilities, it's not landing quite right.
Exactly. I think it needs to be chilling.
Yeah. Like,
it needs to be hollow and scary.
Yeah. Like, you know, start with him killing someone and then having his morning routine washing blood off his face, right? Or something.
I don't know, because I think the psychopathy comes from his listing. And
yeah.
This is what's strange. Matt Smith definitely did this. Ben Walker, I can't really tell. But yeah, so one of my friends who saw it, basically, he'd stop the show. If people were out of line in the audience, he'd stop the show and he'd look at them. And he'd have this kind of moment of, what the fuck are you doing?
Interesting.
Do you know what I mean?
Do you think it was
Patrick Bateman doing it
or was it Matt Smith doing it?
No, it's totally intentional.
Okay.
And it is to kind of assert, like, that is where the horror element comes in, because it's that idea of we're here.
I might kill you. I might kill you right now.
And what I would love is when they're laughing at him in the opening routine, if he just gives them that look as if to say, you can't laugh.
Yeah. Why is that funny?
This is very serious.
Yeah. Yeah.
That
would be a super good fix, especially since the opening sets the tone. Like,
exactly, that's it. And instead, I feel like a lot of times he plays them for laughs.
Right. Like, oh, the 80s. What a ridiculous time.
Like, it's... That's a really niche example. I hope someone out there gets it. You won't. Sorry. There's a character in one of my favorite plays called Abigail's Party.
Okay.
It's a husband character called Lawrence, and he's kind of like pseudo-intellectual. I can't go into all the depth of this. Basically, it's like class drama, comedy. He's a total pseudo-intellectual, and he's trying to connect with someone else at this party who is also a little bit intellectual by showing off his complete works of Shakespeare.
Okay.
And it's really similar in tone with something that Patrick Bateman would do. You know, like, describes it as like the leather bound, the gold around, the gilding of the pages around the edge. He shows her it really, really neatly. And it's like, you just really pity him at that point, because you're like, you're obsessing about the wrong things.
Yeah.
Like, this really means nothing.
Yeah.
And you don't really get it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you need to enforce there. You need to get... You're swiping in with your pity.
Right.
As opposed to, like, I'm naming brands.
Yeah, exactly.
Laugh.
Yeah.
Ha, ha, ha.
What? How fun.
And it kind of... It's that annoying thing, like, that does seem to crop up quite a lot of people naming things in popular culture and people being like, ha ha ha, I understand that.
Yeah. When it seems like it would be a hard thing to do right, especially if the book is so filled with so many lists. Like, if
oh
you
my
wanna...
God, it's constant. Like, every single chapter he will describe and what he's wearing, what everyone else is wearing.
If you want to be true to that, you have to include that.
Totally.
But getting the tone right is where the musical, especially early on, seems to have missed it. Because I do think that the show gets scarier as it goes. You know, due in no small part to, like, Patrick Bateman losing all his clothes and being covered in blood for most of Act 2. Like, that can be scary. But they wait a little too long to get there.
Yeah.
And so you're just kind of bored by that point, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. But again, is that, does it need to be scary? Are you looking at, like, it just, you need to get that coldness.
Yeah. I mean, maybe scary is the wrong word. It needs to be frightening. It needs to be...
chilling.
Know, chilling. Yeah, that's a good word for it. There's a lot of nuance there.
It's a passive. It's a passive fear.
Yeah, it's a psychological thriller without the thriller. Maybe that's why they call it American Psycho. But it misses a lot of that psychological bit.
It does. I just think it could be.
It could be so much.
So good.
And was so close. It is beautiful. It's beautiful to watch. The music.
I know.
The music's super catchy.
And there's nothing like it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. And it's like, it's one of those things, like, hats off to them for tackling this.
Yeah, like running
because it is
straight into it.
Like, it's such a difficult piece of fiction. Like, I could never imagine.
Yeah, and like, not just a difficult Heidi book, but also a really popular film that, like, people are going to expect, and that you're passionate about the story for the right reasons, but know that you have to cater to people who are passionate about the movie for the wrong reasons. Like,
I guess it'd be like if someone was trying to do, like, well, I guess, like, a Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, yeah.
The musical. Because, like, I've seen a stage play of Clockwork Orange, and it works very well.
I think there is a Clockwork Orange musical.
No.
Yeah. I think this crossed my radar maybe a year or two ago off-Broadway.
That surely wouldn't be good.
Yeah, look, here's a bunch of shirtless people. John O'Davies will reprise his performance as Alex DeLarge in the off-Broadway transfer of the London production.
Wait.
Oh, is this just the play?
Yeah.
That's just the play.
Yeah, apparently a musical version premiered in 1988 in Germany.
Ooh, interesting.
And then apparently a better-known musical version popped up in London at the Barbican in 1990. So it does exist. Someone's done it. Yeah. Anyway.
I do feel like A Clockwork Orange is a good example. I was going to say Back to the Future, at least as like the...
Oh, but see, with Back to the Future...
It's not as heady. It's not as heighted.
Exactly. You can have fun at it. Same with Heathers.
Yeah, exactly. Like, because of how it exists in its original form. Whereas something like A Clockwork Orange, because of that deep-seated heightenedness, you need to stay true to that. But... American Psycho. Maybe we'll see more of it one day.
I do hope so, and I hope it's better. But that's not to say it's not good.
Yeah. No, it just needs a couple tweaks here and there and to not open across the street from Hamilton.
Yep.
Am I just an effect of a modern phase? Am I just the end point of the grand parade? Should we be afraid?
I am not a
was American Psycho.
It was indeed. I can rest easy now.
It's true. I can go return those videotapes now.
Hey, well done. We went the whole podcast without referring to that once.
Not a once. And I did. I purchased it on Amazon Prime too, so I don't even get the pleasure of like bringing the
it's
VHS
Netflix.
Back to. It was not. It might be on
it's
your
on our
Netflix.
Ugh. Says it all. That says it all.
American Netflix. Why must you do this to me?
Exactly.
I had to spend a whole $2 on it.
Shocking. But totally worth it, right?
Totally worth it. Great movie.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Have you ever read The Life of Pi?
Nope.
If you had, you'd understand why I'd bring it up. I'm not going to go any further. Just in case you do read it. Just in case you do read it.
I got two things to look up. Life of Pi and Magical Sponges Lady.
Oh, just you wait. Oh, you're going to love her.
What should
She's
I do?
She's going to change your life, partially.
What should I do first? Read The Life of Pi or look up the Sponges Lady?
Oh, Sponge Lady. Sponge Lady, and then just enjoy Life of Pi. Read the book before you see the film. That's
Kay.
A note to anyone who's never seen either.
Yeah.
Very important.
It's what I'm trying to do before
first.
I see Incredibles 2, to read the
but
book
the way,
first.
So I haven't... Yeah, hugely funny. I haven't...
You're so supportive of my comedy career.
So good. I haven't seen Incredibles 2 yet. I don't think it's out over here yet. I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
But one thing I've seen is like, this was what it was like in Incredibles 1, and this is what it's like in Incredibles 2.
Yeah.
Is it like a mashup?
No, it's, I believe, I haven't seen it yet, but I believe it picks up right where the last one left off. But because animation technology has changed so rapidly in the past, whatever, 5-7 years.
Yeah.
There are a bunch of characters, like, everyone looks much more detailed and has much more flowy hair and things
I
like
guess
that.
That scene was at the end, the one that I saw. That
the,
makes sense.
The Underminer! Yeah.
No? It wasn't that one. It was the one with Violet flirting with the boy.
Yes, and the boy, who I believe, yes, I said this too, who is a more positive character, or a more main character.
Like featured.
But of course, then they gave him more polygons and more personality, which, you know,
exactly.
We all need both of.
Absolutely. I've been trying to find some polygons recently. You just can't get them anywhere.
It's really hard. It's hard to be a man searching for polygons in today's day and
Always.
Age.
And speaking of polygons, I've got a... Equipment.
Equipment. Speaking of polygons.
Will we ever do a question again?
Who knows? What a good question.
Right? So are you ready?
I'm ready.
You're excited about this one, I can tell.
I really am.
Two of the actresses who have played the title role in this musical have only ever had one conversation with each other, and it went as follows. One actress said to the other, "I'm taller than you."
Petty to a T. If you want to get in contact with us, I'm Musical Mash on Twitter and Musical Theater Mash on YouTube.
And I am Asen Hendricks on Twitter. And you can come and find us both at Jim and Tomic.
Send us funny GIFs.
Always.
Yeah.
And I'll send you some back.
Yeah. We're always down for a funny GIF. I've got a GIF. I've started building my B. Arthur GIF folder. I don't know why. It just struck
Excellent.
Me one night, but, you know, useful to have.
Have you got like a favorite?
GIF?
Not a favorite B. Arthur, just a favorite GIF.
My favorite B. Arthur is B. Arthur. do I have a favorite GIF? I don't know. I might have to think on that one. Do you have one?
I've got like two that I always use quite a lot.
Okay.
One is weird. It's Coco Montrese like looking sassy and like moving her head.
Okay.
In one of the, like the talking heads. The other one is the cow with the hair.
The cow with the hair. I've never seen this.
It's like the windswept cow.
Nope.
Do you use the internet?
Nope. I have no idea what it is. Although Ridiculous. I do think we need to start a spin-off podcast where we just describe GIFs verbally via the podcast. It'd be wildly popular.
Hugely popular.
If you want to hear more about this podcast, head to jimatomic.com. It's got a link to the Reddit discussion, a link to the Gold Star promo code, and a link to, I don't know, a bunch of other stuff.
Exactly. And if you would like to support the podcast, we would be very grateful for that. You can head on over to our Patreon. The link is on the website.
And that's it. We'll see you next time.
next time. I have the power to cut this, you know.
I know, but you're gonna leave it in.
I can stab it out before it gets
once
ridiculous.
On the highlands.
Can I just start going, I like it like that. I like hard bodies.
Why is there an ice cube in my soy sauce?
To chill it, Courtney. Great.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.